Just a moment here, we're starting the recording. Hello everyone and welcome to Attitude Builders, a membership where we offer monthly programs to help you develop yourself and your staff with no prep, no plan, and no problem. Each month, your host, Marlene Chisholm, provides practical training to help you manage stress, improve communication, and develop yourself and your staff. And now let me introduce your host, Marlene Chisholm, founder of Stop Your Drama and Attitude Builders.
Thank you. Welcome everybody and welcome to all the new members. I'm very excited about our guest today because I've read the book, and as I was saying before we turned on the recording, I have it tagged with all kinds of highlighter notes and little yellow tags sticking out because it's just a great reference book. So before we get started, I just want to give you a framework and introduce the guest. Have you ever been sort of disappointed or upset with yourself and you said, well, you know what, that's just the way I am. I can't change. Well, if you've ever thought that you couldn't change your life for the better, I have really good news for you. You can change. Your brain is not hardwired. A revolution in science has recently revealed that the adult brain remains open to change throughout the lifespan. In today's Attitude Builders program, my guest, Rick Hansen, is going to talk about how you can use your mind to change your brain. The simple truth is you can learn to focus your attention to intentionally direct the energy and information through your neural circuits to alter the brain's activity and structure. So if there's any area in your life that you want to change, whether that's your relationship with yourself, your relationship with others, or you want to reduce anxiety, improve personal performance, or you want to tap into more wisdom, happiness, and love, you're in the right place today. Rick Hansen, PhD, is a neuropsychologist, a meditation teacher, and weekly contributor to psychologytoday.com. Rick has written and taught extensively about the essential inner skills of personal well-being, psychological growth, and contemplative practice, as well as about relationships, family life, and raising children. He founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and is the author of Buddha's Brain, the Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
I am so excited to have you here today that we're probably just going to run out of time. I just wanted to start out with a question that I think will give everyone some clarity. The difference between the brain and the mind. What do you mean by the saying, when you change your mind, your brain changes?
Sure. It's the difference between a CD or DVD and the music that's on it. In other words, the brain is material. It's the meat, forgive the expression, whereas mm-hmm. the mind is the meanings or the information that's flowing through the nervous system. For example, if you look at and see a tree or you hear the words right now that we're speaking, the mind, which is, you know, made of, or probably the brain, which is made of over a trillion cells, over 100 billion neurons, is processing that information and turning it into meaning in the mind right now. I mean, it may sound kind of mysterious, but it's sort of simple. If you think about it, another way I think about it is a TV screen is made of matter, but the pictures we see on it or the words that stream across it are information that give us meaning. And just as the TV screen changes to convey meaning, your brain changes right now to let you make sense of the world.
Wow, so that's a good distinction because I hear people using those words to mean the same thing, you know, change your brain or change your mind, but really they work together, but they're separate ways of behaving.
Yeah, a computer's a good metaphor. The brain is the hardware. The mind is the software.
Wow, everybody
you know,
can relate to that.
Yeah, for better or worse. you know when your hard drive is messed up, you know, you got a problem there in Houston. You know, and it's also true that you can have perfectly good computers, as it were, that on the one hand can hold all kinds of horrible things like terrible pictures or, you know, terrible words and whatnot, or you can have the same computer holding much happier or much more productive or effective in the workplace, you know, pictures and words.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference, though, that's critical here it's kind of a good analogy. You know, as you move information through a computer, you can actually change the computer. To make the analogy right, you know, as you know, as you load, you know, different pages on an internet, it would be as if the computer is actually remembering those pages, which it does in a sense with cookies
mm-hmm.
and whatnot. And that idea right there is at the heart of what we're talking about today, which I thought you said better than I've ever heard anyone say it. And I want to write down the way you introduced me here because you really said it well.
Well, I will send you a copy of this. You can use it on your own website.
Oh, I'd appreciate it. The basic idea is that, you know, at a time when the world seems topsy-turvy and people feel so pushed around, including by their own reactions to daily life, traffic jams, you know, corporate downsizing, layoffs, too much pressure, worries about health insurance, kids in school, whatever. At this time, we now have the increasing ability through science meeting up with thousands of years of, you know, kind of the Olympic athletes of mental training, the people that have been doing contemplative practice and all the world's traditions, Christianity, Buddhism, Judaism, and all the rest. Anyway, we
well,
now
that's
have
what
the ability
I, yeah. Go ahead.
To reach down inside the mind, inside the brain, because we're getting more and more of a manual to reach down inside the black box and change it for the better. And that gives us an absolutely historically unprecedented power, particularly at a time when we feel so pushed around by things, to get in the driver's seat with regard to our own brain.
I really love your book, and what I love so much about it, and I want to just express this to anyone on the call that wants to get the book, don't let the word Buddha's brain, I know I've had people that, you know, are of a Christian religion thinking that this is about religion. It's not about religion. This book ties in spirituality and science to help you, like you said, be the driver.
That's right. I've profound respect for Christianity, Jesus Christ, and all the rest. And in a way, it was out of respect that I didn't want to say Jesus's brain.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that is good about Buddha as a historical figure is he did not claim any particular religious authority or divine inspiration. He simply always represented himself as a person who trained his mind, and which really means, of course, training his own brain. And anyone who, you know, it's interesting the way I think about it is that if you want to get good at something, study the people that are good at it, right?
Mm.
So if you want to get good at golf, study good golfers. You want to mm-hmm. become a better cook, watch Top Chef or something.
Absolutely.
Study the people that are good at it. Well, who are the people that are really good at being happy or productive or effective? And a lot of them are found in the contemplative tradition, so I use the Buddha as an example of that. But the same thing is true today when you think about astronauts or, you know, top performers in a work environment. What's going on inside their brain? Because that's what's enabling them to be so productive and happy and stress-free. And then with reverse engineering, we can start figuring out what's going on inside their brain and activate those brain states. So I wrote the book, Buddha's Brain, as a kind of operating manual for how people can actually activate those brain states inside their own head. And what's great about the brain is that when you activate it, you change it. In other words, when you stimulate it, you strengthen it. It is like weightlifting. You know, if you lift the weight, you actually build muscle. If you lift it once, you build a little muscle. If you lift it a lot, if you lift it many, many times and with a fair amount of weight and across many, many days, you're going to build a lot of muscle. The same is true in the brain. You got to earn it. I mean, sometimes people can think about this personal growth territory as sort of, you know, wimpy or, you know, new agey or something like that. You know, I've become very hard-boiled about it. You know, I've been a therapist for a long, long time. It's made me more compassionate, but it's made me tough as nails in a sense.
Absolutely.
That you got to earn it. You got to do the work.
Well, and something that really came up for me in your book, and this is not on the learning guide, but I think it is good to bring up based on what you just said. You said in the book the single most powerful way to reshape your brain is to control where you put your attention. And, you know, I've heard the statement that what you focus on expands, and I've been doing meditation and prayer work for quite a long time every morning, and it has really increased my ability to focus and to be calm because I tend to be a very creative person and my mind can be all over the place. So I can imagine how this could help a company that just decided to do a little bit of meditation. I know that's really far-reaching for a lot of people, but you also said that business schools and hospitals are learning these techniques to become more productive and less stressed.
Oh, it's actually quite startling. For example, you know, I do have a business background before I became a psychologist, and it's interesting. The ultimate attitude in business and in science is to be empirical, which means you basically are interested in facts, and to be pragmatic. You know, you want results. Well, it's interesting that the people who've been, you know, meditating over the years had exactly the same orientation. They wanted to know what was factually true, and they wanted stuff that worked, which is why, very interestingly, increasingly, in Fortune 500 companies, I guarantee you, right now in a Fortune 500 company in America today, people are learning mindfulness skills because tons of research and just ordinary experience is showing, just like you described, that when you use your mind in that way, in other words, to control your attention so it's not so scattered everywhere, and to establish a kind of distance from what flows through your mind so that you're not so hijacked by it.
Mm-hmm.
When you do that, you literally build neural structures. You make them thicker, literally. You thicken the brain in the regions that handle that skill. And then as a result, you're much more able to be productive and effective at work. So that's why businesses are turning to these practices increasingly, because you know, when you corporate downsize and you need more results from the people you've got, the best investment in a way you can make, which you know better than I do from your programs here, the best investment you can make is improving the productivity of your people. And happy people are productive people, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, I was going through the book a little bit before we started this because I'd like to review, and you mentioned something about the importance, and I write about this a lot too, and it seems like it's challenging to get people to agree to this right now with technology and BlackBerries and our attention being so scattered and so divided. But you talk about the importance of slowing down, stop the multitasking, and to really focus. How do you get people to understand the importance of that with this 24/7 mentality of always being plugged up?
I think the place to start is the Dr. Phil question. You know,
how's that working for you?
I love that question. You know, how's that working for you? And sometimes, honestly, and I'm this way too, I'm in the real world, you feel like an ER doc, right, or a short order cook,
mm-hmm.
stuff flying, whether you're just getting the kids out the door to school or dealing with a really crazy day, you really do have to rev up. Okay, but we did not evolve biologically. You know, biological evolution really is a fact. The nervous system's been developing for 600 million years, and it's really powerful to appreciate how much it's changed over time and how long this journey has been. For example, people started making stone tools about 2.5 million years ago, but they had brains a third the size of ours. Interestingly, while the brain has tripled in size in the last 2.5 million years, that's 100,000 generations or so, most of that build-out of real estate, if you will, in the 3 pounds of tofu between the ears, is for relationships. It's for relationship skills. It's for cooperative planning, language, empathy, love, bonding, and all the rest of that. So, but the larger point is that as we evolved, we did not evolve to live the way we do today in many ways. In other words, we evolved to handle bursts of stress, but not low-grade chronic stress. And as a result, people are having lifestyle illnesses, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, breakdowns in the immune system, because stress really weakens the immune system. That's why people start getting colds and flus when they get stressed.
Mm-hmm.
Disrupts hormonal system, hormonal balances and cycling and all the rest of that. So, plus it really wears on well-being. Stress is depressing. Stress is also anxiety-provoking because it keys us up, so we're constantly scanning for threats, which we tend to do already, and now we're on overdrive. So, you know, it's a bargain with the devil. I mean, it's not a pretty picture to live in a chronic stress world. So the first step, I think, is the Dr. Phil question. How's that working for you?
Uh-huh.
Not that well. You know, it's all about motivation. Do you understand that this is not helpful? Second thing is, if you really watch the peak performers, the peak performance zone is basically relaxed and alert with a mild sense of positive enthusiasm. You know, that's what you can sustain for the marathon. We can't run a marathon at the pace of a sprint. So when you watch those people what you see is that they settle their attention on things and they complete them. And in other words, they move to completion on A before they jump on to B. And,
wow.
Right there is a very powerful practice. You know, the finish one thing before you shift gears to the next thing. A second thing is, honestly, don't let yourself be interrupted unless you absolutely have to be. In other words, ask people to wait till you finish the call, you know.
Right.
When you're trying to write a memo, don't have your, you know, attention skittering out all the time to, you know, what's the latest email you've gotten. I see people in important conversations. I've seen people at Thanksgiving dinner checking their BlackBerries.
Mm.
That's bizarre.
It is.
If you've got a patient in the hospital who's about to die, all right. But otherwise, put it away. You know,
it's funny to be in restaurants and watching two people having dinner, and they're both like on their, they're both tweeting and twittering and texting, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what has happened to us? And driving and doing that.
Yeah, the truth is, it's not happy, and this is where I write about in the book. An absolutely critical point here is to get on your own side. In other words, to really ask yourself, how's my life going in terms of what it feels like to be me? Am I on my own side? Does my own stress, tension, worry, or just feeling jangled or frazzled or pushed around by the world, does that matter to me? And for a lot of people, honestly, they're kind of numb to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the first step is to open up and go, wow, my life matters to me. As far as I know, it's the only life I get. Definitely
mm-hmm.
the only life I get is this personality. At least at this realm, you know, in this world, in this plane. And so what do I want to make of it, for better or worse? And the days are precious, you know. I just see a lot of people walking around, you know, it's Thoreau's line, you know, most men lead lives of quiet desperation. And could be a bit of an extreme statement, but there's a lot of truth to it. People just kind of get, you know, they walk through their life. And what I'm here to say, in a sense, is that the truth is that even if you're in a tough situation, you know, you've got to work two jobs or you're dealing with a family situation while working one job or whatever it is, deep down inside, there's always something you can do to help yourself feel better and be more productive in your particular situation. And there are hard-boiled, scientifically-based methods for being able to do that. Maybe we could start talking about what some of those actual
methods
are.
Let's do that, because I want to answer one question before we do that. I've got stress and suffering, anxiety, that as a topic, techniques for personal power and relationships. So those things are on the learning guide. And just to tie that in, I want you to just briefly explain why the brain is Velcro for negative and Teflon for positive. Then let's go into some techniques.
Sure, great. Well, this idea is really important. So as we evolved, you know, biologically, our home base is, I think of it as the three C's, is calm, contented, and caring. In other words, when we're not hungry or in pain or rattled, you know, by 40,000,
mm-hmm.
by, you know, having to process 100 emails a day,
mm-hmm.
You know, take 50 calls a day and all the rest of that, when we're not rattled, who are we? And we're not scared, who are we? We're nice people, right? The resting state is relaxed, mild kind of well-being and happiness, and good wishes for other people. That's our home base.
Mm.
The problem is that we evolved to be capable of being driven from home just like that. The crack of a twig in the bushes, a cough of a leopard, or aggression in our, you know, band that we evolved in. In other words, our ancestors, who are way chill, dude, you know, I'm a California guy, so I know the language. You know, our ancestors who are all mellow and blissed out all the time, chomp, they got nailed by
mm-hmm.
the local, you know, tiger or dinosaur back, you know, when we were, you know, way long ago in evolution. And so we have the ones who survived were nervous and cranky. So as a result, the brain basically has what science calls a negativity bias. In other words, it's constantly scanning for threats and reacting to them. Because if you think about it, carrots and sticks, you know, we go through life, we want to get the carrots and we want to avoid the sticks.
Mm-hmm.
But if you miss a carrot today, you'll get another crack tomorrow. But if you miss a stick today, whap, no more carrots for the rest of your life because you're off the game board.
Mm.
So, you know, the brain basically looks for those sticks, and then when it sees them, it remembers them, and it and it pulls them up from storage at the least sign of anything similar to them. That's why the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. In other words, isn't it true that at the end of a day, right, 100 things have happened, little things, what's the one you remember?
The one upset.
Yeah, or the one thing the person said that just sticks in your head and you kind of grind away on it, or, you know, you did a good job, but your boss pointed out the one typo in the memo or something like that. That's the one thing you think about. And it's not fair. In other words, the brain is tilted toward passing on the genes, but it's tilted against quality of life. So if
Wow.
we care about quality of life, yeah, it's not fair. It's so unjust. If it's, you know, and the truth is it ends up with how people feel about themselves. They start feeling bad about themselves because there's a growing pile. It's like positive experiences go through the brain like water through a sieve, but negative information, it just gets captured, you know, just like that. So the result is this growing sense in what science calls implicit memory, not so much memory for events, but the deep experience of what it feels like to be me, which starts to feel kind of down, or
wow.
like, I'm not that good, you know,
yeah.
or, and then people put on us, people are plucky, people are wonderful, they, you know, they buck up, they go forward, and also people are embarrassed about admitting how they really feel deep down, because it's kind of humiliating, maybe, or they look around, and everybody else has a happy, smiling mask on, so they think it must be only me who's like this. Trust me, I've been a therapist forever, it's everybody.
Glad to hear you confirm this, because I've told people, like when I'm on the stage speaking or when I'm doing training, I'll say something like, I have this theory that deep down in some area, every single one of us feel pretty unworthy, and I'm the only one that's willing to admit it.
Oh, you're wonderful. You so help people when you do that.
Because
you give everybody permission.
Because I know, as much as I work on my life and I still have, you know, times like that, it's not as often because of the meditation and the practices that I'm doing, but there are times when I see it appearing, and, you know, I know that if I consciously focus on the meditation and the positive and all this and I still get it, I wonder about people that don't do these things.
Oh, exactly true. So the way I look at it is, if you're on your own side, I mean, I'm a mellow guy, you know, I'm a therapist and a meditation teacher, whatever, but there's, you know, I'm competitive, and I don't like being pushed around, and I have a lot of background in rock climbing and mountaineering and stuff, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, the thing is, what really pushes us around? It isn't what's out there in the world. I mean, yeah, what's out there in the world pushes around some, but what mostly pushes us around, what mostly is the puppet master yanking our strings, is inside our own minds. And that's what I want to take up arms against. You know, take up arms against your oppressors. Most of what oppresses a person is the habit patterns inside their own mind. So that's why if you get on your own side, you want to change it. That's why I think you got to really...
You call that the second dart or something in your book, the first and second dart?
Yeah, exactly right. In other words, the negativity bias doesn't care how we feel. It just wants to keep us alive and pass on the genes. So to truly level the playing field, because it's tilted against happiness and well-being, in ancient times, a long lifespan was irrelevant because people were having babies, you know, when they were 15 years old, and they were dead when they were 35. But if you want quality of life here and now, and you also want to not wear and tear through upsets. In other words, when people are upset, when people feel bad, that creates a stress reaction that, you know, sends out all kinds of hormones that will over time kill you, in effect. And
yeah.
So if people want to feel good here and now, and they want to feel good when they're 60, 70, and 80, and be a great grandparent or whatever, you don't have an active life, it's really important to tilt for yourself and really focus on positive experiences. And then in particular, when you observe positive facts, most of which are fairly minor. They're just everyday positive facts, but they are positive facts, like it's a nice day, or I'm alive, or this sticky bun tastes good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or this shower feels good, or that person smiled at me, or I got this thing done, I finished the laundry, I got the emails out the door, we got the quarterly report to bed, or I noticed this good thing in myself, you know, ordinary virtue, like I have some pluck or determination or patience or lovingness. Anyway, whenever we notice those positive facts, I talk about this as in the fourth chapter of the book is taking the good. Three steps. One, let the positive fact become a positive experience. Two, dwell on it for 10, 20, 30 seconds, because that's how you defeat the negativity bias. You got to get those neurons firing together, because that's what makes them wire together. Famous saying, brain science, neurons that fire together, wire together. And it's kind of mechanical. The more of them that fire, the more them, the more intensively they fire, and the longer they fire, the more they're going to wire. And when they wire, they literally build new neural structure, new circuits inside your own head. That's the second step. Just stay with it. It's private. No one needs to know that you're feeling good. You know, it's a secret act of happiness. And then third step, sense and intend that this positive experience is sinking into you. It's sinking into your body. It's becoming woven into the fabric of your brain and yourself. And if you do that half a dozen times a day, taking in the good, within weeks, you'll feel better. It'll develop resilience, self-confidence. It'll lift mood. It'll help you feel less anxious. It's a very simple practice, for example, and I have a lot of other practices in the book, but this is one of my favorite ones. I use it myself all the time because that's how you can really help yourself build resources inside that then you can use to go out into the world.
Wow, I love that. And what came to mind for me, you may even have this in the book, may not be my idea. Maybe I'm just taking something from you, but I was going to ask you about it. What if a business or a practice decided that every day every person is going to look for something to compliment in their coworkers and start building that practice to do that for other people? And then, you know, having the person themselves that was complimented be able to, like, kind of soak in that all day. I mean, wouldn't that improve productivity?
I guarantee it would, and it's not in the book. It's a beautiful idea. The idea of soaking it in, you know, is in the book. But what you're saying is just fantastic. And it, in a way, it goes to larger issues, too, about how really profoundly social we are as human beings. We're very relational, for better or worse. And so if we're in an environment that, you know, feels kind of like a war zone where everybody's working incredibly hard and, you know, bombs are dropping and it's like one crazy thing after another, we sort of soak that up, and then we act that way ourselves. It's called emotional contagion. It's like a virus, you know, passing around. On the other hand, if you're in a workplace where people are acknowledging and appreciative, then, you know, and affirming, they see the best in you. You start to see the best in yourself. And then on the basis, and then you bring the best in yourself out into your work, and you have confidence in it, and therefore, as a result, just as you said, you become more effective and productive, and it goes also, of course, to the bottom line of the company. You know, makes a more profitable situation there.
Well, and you know, I work with a virtual team, and they're in different places, you know, across the United States, and I just absolutely love everyone that works with me, and I couldn't do without them, and I try to express it. But I rely on them, too, for when I'm a little bit down and they say, hey, you're doing it right. You're doing everything you need to do. Here's an idea. And I just look so forward to the people that work with me, and I know that that can happen inside a building.
That's true. It's interesting. You made me think that, I mean, as we go through the day, there's a little part of our mind and therefore our brain that is passing judgment kind of all day long. It's passing judgment about the world, you know, the coffee here, the person there, what they look like, and all the rest. But really, it's continually passing judgment on ourselves.
Right? Mm.
The problem is, because of the negativity bias and the slowly accumulating pile of sort of negative experiences and negative views of ourselves, that judgment that gets rendered, you know, like the court inside our own head, becomes increasingly biased. It becomes increasingly critical and kind of undermining and self-doubting, even if it's covered over with a kind of bravura or kind of a braggadocio of like hyperconfidence or I'm superstar, whatever. You know, don't you sense that in a lot of people who present themselves that way, that
yes,
behind that surface there's a lot of self-doubt? Well, that's the judge inside. You know, that's that passing judgment. And I feel very moved by this in the sense that it's unfair. The judgment that's being passed on us inside our own head is almost guaranteed to be unfair and biased or negative.
Well,
yeah,
and I do believe.
Make up arms.
What did you say?
Well, that's why we have to take up arms against our oppressor, in a sense, inside our own head, and not in some nutty way, you know, but in a quiet, determined, long, you know, taking the long view kind of way.
Yes.
Increasingly look for the good in ourselves, increasingly take it in when other people see it in ourselves, and increasingly talk back inside our own mind to that inner critic that's, you know, so harsh and so mean and so unfair.
You know, when I had a career for 21 years before I started this, and I wasn't really a career, it was a job. I worked in a factory, and that transitional time between leaving and changing the identity, and you talk a lot about that in your book of changing yourself, that it changes by situation and all kinds of other things. But in that middle time, my mind was playing so many tricks on me, it seemed like I would beat myself up, and someone gave me just a little technique that helped me to kind of get over the hump, and it was that when I heard myself saying, "You must be crazy. How could you quit after 21 years? You're behind. You know, you haven't finished your college degree, all this." I would just say, "Thank you for sharing." And it was a way to acknowledge it and, you know, not make it a big deal, just to kind of, like, hear it, acknowledge it, and that helped me so much.
Yes. I think that's wonderful that you did that. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want you to share go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just saying that, you know, one thing that's great is that, you know, you're offering your own experience as a model for others, and that's a lot how we learn. You know, we appreciate what other people do. Yeah.
Absolutely. And just to know that, you know, within any change, and I know a lot of people are going through changes right now, like you said, we're always scanning for threats, and change feels threatening. You know, am I going to lose my job? What if things aren't as good as they were? What's this change going to mean to me? So just even some mantras like, "Oh, well, thank you for sharing," or "I've always come out ahead. It's always worked for my best." In fact, my minister last week at church said something that has just been on my mind, and it's been so helpful. She said, "The universe is always on your side. You know, love is always there to support you." And just that thought is so helpful.
I think that's wonderful.
Well, I want you to share with people. I know you're wanting to share some specific techniques for personal power, and I'll let you go wherever you want to with the techniques, and then how you mentioned that we're so relational. So within the context of relationships or techniques to better our lives, just go for it.
Well, that's great. Well, the first method that I've mentioned so far is the idea of taking in the good, which, you know, just to review, three simple steps: turn positive facts into positive experiences. Second, dwell on it, 20, 30 seconds, just straight. Let yourself feel good for half a minute straight. Notice any resistance to that, which is quite interesting. A lot of people resist feeling good, which is interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then third step, sense and intend that it's sinking into you. So that's one method. Actually, I would just call out as well a second thing that I've said so far, which is to really get on your own side. That's actually really important to do. And one way to do that involves this fancy phrase called embodied cognition. Cognition means thinking. Embodied means, you know, thinking that's embedded in the body. And the research is showing that a lot of what we used to think of as just pure thought is actually grounded in the way the body is held, its posture, the way it moves, and so forth. So, for example, if you want to get more on your own side and feel stronger, move your body into that position. Straighten up your chest. Lift your chest out. Raise your head as if you're strong and dignified. Imagine standing like a king or a queen, just sort of natural, relaxed dignity. And that physical posture will help bring up the mental attitude of being on your own side. Or
wow.
Alternately, bring... Yeah, isn't that powerful?
Oh, my gosh, this is so huge.
Oh, it's huge. Little thing, if you want to feel a little better, put on a half smile. You know, a little thing like, if my wife is talking to me and she's got a problem, and it could be me, you know, and I want to, like, get me out of this conversation, but I've learned to experience that that's the wrong thing to do, I will make myself subtly lean forward, you know, by half an inch or a quarter inch or an inch, and that leaning forward toward her will draw my mind more into the interaction with her. Literally,
wow.
I'm more in it because I've moved my body into that position. So that's another really, really good method.
Well, and I can see how that would work for customer service too. Like your natural reaction is when someone starts complaining and having a bunch of drama, you want to defend or say, hey, well, it was you that didn't understand the, you know, the code or the date or whatever, to be able to take a breath and lean in. Like, I'm interested and I'm here to solve the problem. It's going to change the reaction.
That's actually true. And maybe I'll just bounce out there with that. You know, what we really, here's the way of saying it. There are three deep fundamental motivational systems in the brain. We want to approach what's pleasant, like the carrots in the world. We want to avoid what's unpleasant, number two, the sticks in the world, by fighting them or fleeing from them or freezing so they just don't notice us and they go away, right? And then there's a third system, which only birds and mammals, and especially primates and especially humans have, which is this affiliation or attachment or bonding system, which makes us want to belong to our group and to connect with other people. In other words, a shark or a crocodile has the approach system and the avoid system, but human beings are more than any other animal on the planet have this attaching system. Okay, and so that attaching system is incredibly important. We really need to belong. We really want to feel connected with other people, and so when we're in a situation where, let's say, we have a complaint, in other words, let's say you're on the other side of customer service. Imagine you're a customer service person, but guess what? The washer isn't working, and you're on the phone with, you know, whoever sold it to you and getting the runaround. How do you feel? The thing that we most want to get in that situation is that the other person cares about our problem.
Wow.
They don't have to pretend to be our best friend, but that they actually care about our problem, and they really want to hear it. They want to receive it. It's kind of like if you're trying to go into a room and the door's closed, you knock on the door stays closed, what do? You keep knocking. But if the door opens, you quit banging on the door.
Mm-hmm.
You walk in, you communicate, and then you move on out of the room usually. And so this need people have to feel affiliated is really deep. And if a person doesn't feel that they're joined with, that's a kind of mini mantra I learned when our kids were young and my kind of detached problem-solving style wasn't going very well. My internal mantra was start by joining. That's a good three words, start by joining.
It's hard
to go wrong if you start by joining. Doesn't mean you agree. Doesn't mean you waive your rights. Doesn't mean you're a doormat. But start by joining. In other words, start with empathy. So I can talk about empathy a little bit.
Yes, I love that part.
Yeah, it's kind of schmancy. Oh, man, empathy is the heart of successful sales. If you think about it, you can't sell well if you're not empathic. It's also at the heart of supervision. You can't manage people if you're not empathic. Now, so what is empathy? Empathy means basically it's the walk a mile in the other person's shoes, is that you get what it's like to be them in some basic way. And in the brain, we literally have three dedicated systems for being empathic with other people. One system tracks the actions of other people, one system their emotions, and a third system their thoughts, you know, the kind of what's swirling through their mind. And the way it does this is just amazing. Have you heard the phrase mirror neurons?
No, I haven't.
Yes? Oh, okay, let me say it real fast. So let's imagine that you reach for a cup, okay? So so you reach for a cup, and if you reach for a cup, Marlene, a certain bunch of neurons will light up in the motor perception circuits of your brain. Okay, fine. Now, if you watch me reach for a cup, some fraction, let's call it 10% ballpark, of the same neurons inside your brain light up when you see me reaching for a cup, which means that you get a sense inside out of what it's like to be me. And that's
okay.
A really useful thing because you're tracking my intentions. You're getting a feeling for what it's like to be me. This happens automatically. You can't stop it, in other words. The same thing happens with emotions. In other words, if you're having a feeling like you're happy or you're sad or you're irritated or you're anxious, a bunch of neurons light up in certain parts of the brain. The term for that part is the insula, which people don't have to remember. It's just that there's a place where it happens. But guess what? If you see me also having a strong feeling about something or worrying about something, a fraction of those same neurons light up inside you. It's as if you're simulating the experience that I'm having. See what,
wow.
I, you see what I mean? How
yeah.
automatic this is? We truly do resonate with other people. It's a little bit like neural Wi-Fi, where there's a kind of internal echo inside our own head. And then there's a third system that does the same thing. That's in the what's called the prefrontal cortex, right behind the forehead, that tracks the thoughts of other people. It's not like we're mind reading. I mean, obviously, if the world is full of war, aggression, and people misunderstanding each other and mistreating each other and all the rest. I mean, we can ignore these empathic signals, but we have these capacities. And so if we want to strengthen them, whether it's to become a better mate or spouse, I'm a guy, I'm for guys, blah, blah, but a lot of guys could honestly improve their empathy skills. isn't it true? I think a lot of women would say, yeah, hello. You know, my first book was about taking good care of mothers and couples, you know, after kids come along over the long haul. And so, one of the things I tell men, and it's not just men who need to do this, is ask your partner three questions a day in a row, and not, you know, did you get my shirts at the cleaners? Just three questions.
What's for dinner, dollars? What's for dinner?
Yeah, no, forget it. Yeah, that one doesn't count. Sorry. What's it like to be you? And it's amazing how often a little thing will make a little difference. Will make a big difference over time. Anyway, so the point is, if you want to become more empathic, science has shown this amazingly interesting thing, which is if you just tune into your own body, like you just kind of be mindful of your breathing, or let's say you're walking the dog and you just say, you know, I'm going to stop worrying about stuff and just kind of keep focusing on what it's like to be here, or, the smell of the flowers, or honestly, in prayer. There are studies that show Carmelite nuns in Montreal doing a prayer where they feel like being the bride of Christ, you know, joined in that very heartfelt way.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, and they wanted to do this, actually, these nuns liked it, that the scanner, the MRI, showed that major parts of their brain were lighting up that had to do with, controlling their attention because they're staying attentive to that particular thing. Second part of the brain that lit up was a part that has to do with sensing their body, the insula, in other words, as I mentioned earlier, lit up. And a third part lit up, which was, fancy term, caudate nucleus, a part of the brain that's involved with reward, with feeling rewarded by things. It also lights up, for example, when something really good happens to us. So, in other words, embodied cognition. They were having a bodily experience of this deep and beautiful prayer they were doing. And as a result, of course, remember when I said earlier, neurons that fire together wire together, as they stimulate a part of the brain, they strengthen its capacities. So over time, doing the prayer, they were deepening their capacity to go into that profundity of prayer.
Wow.
And so beautiful thing, right? Interestingly, when people tune into themselves in whatever way, prayer, mindfulness, meditation, feeling into the body while working on their golf game or, you know, whatever it is, just honestly tuning into the body while cooking, you know, just kind of staying present with the sensations of the body, literally the tissues, the neural tissues of the insula grow thicker because you're building synapses, those little connections between neurons, and you're building blood flow to that area. So it gets thicker and thicker. And just like a muscle, when it gets thicker, it has more capacity. Then,
that is so exciting. It is so
it
exciting.
Is.
Yeah,
you can change your brain. But my point is, when you do that, you can also tune better into other people.
I just love the empowerment that this offers. And I want to break just for a minute because we're just about out of time. I want to make sure I get in an opportunity for any questions. So I'm going to check in with Jocelyn real quick and see if anyone has, if there's any questions that's come in.
Yeah, there are no questions at the moment. I think it's been really rich and informative, so thank you so much for sharing. But no,
I know,
questions.
I'm just getting mesmerized by
yeah.
it, so I thought, oops, I looked up at the clock. And
I'm taking notes myself and looking over your website as we speak, so it's great. Thank you.
Oh, good.
So we have about 5 minutes. I'm going to let you go where you want to go, whether it's about relationships and other technique or anything that you want to share with us.
Oh, sure. Well, just to kind of summarize what I said, you know, with some, wandering around a little bit, the point about empathy here is if you just tune into your own body 5, 10, 20 minutes a day, you will strengthen the insula, which will help you be more self-aware, but it will also help you be more able to track the emotions of other people. Isn't that kind of interesting that by just tuning into your own body, you strengthen the ability to empathically tune in to others? I think that's great.
And I so get that. I used to say that you can only be as honest as your own level of awareness. You know, and until we become really aware of how we feel and what's going on for us, as you said earlier, we put on the act, you know, there's this super, I'm confident or I'm sarcastic, and I find that whatever our real issues are, they leak out. So you might as well just get quiet and learn to experience who you think you are and your feelings, because until you can be aware of yourself, it's difficult to be aware of others.
That's right. That's right. Totally agree. To help me remember and stand track, I'm going to touch 3 points quickly here. The last one will kind of open up to some things. The first is that if people are interested in a whole bunch of free resources, they can go to my website, which they can reach through buddhasbrain.com. That'll take them to my website. I have a lot of talks. I have a lot of I list a whole bunch of scientific papers that are in this area, but I also have a lot of very practical things there, including the PowerPoint slides from many, many workshops and talks I've given, and they're freely available to people. They're freely offered. And in particular, I do this weekly newsletter called Just One Thing. It's freely offered. It's one simple practice a week you can do to change your life. So, for example, one practice was take in the good. Another practice was be grateful. Just one simple thing per week that can change your life. And so they can sign up if they like for the Just One Thing newsletter.
Love that.
They can subscribe anytime.
And that's at buddhasbrain.com?
That's right, buddhasbrain.com. The second thing I want to say, just in passing, is that, you know, one thing I've been moved by, honestly, is the way in which the contemplative side of the world's great religions is becoming more apparent, including in Christianity. And I just want to mention something that might be of interest to a lot of listeners called centering prayer, which is many people might know about this already. Father Thomas Keating is probably one of the main people that's put that forward. But if people just simply Google centering prayer, it's a very rich contemplative practice. It's very prayerful that people can do that. I've seen Father Keating at conferences, and he's the real deal. It's really great, and that's something I think that people might have interest in. The third thing I want to mention in my remaining moments is self-compassion, which was embedded in what you said earlier. It's this practice that's getting a lot of research attention these days where people bring compassion to themselves. It doesn't mean self-pity, and it doesn't mean wallowing. It's a simple experience that we would have for a dear friend, where we wish them well, and there's a kind of tender, sympathetic concern for the difficult thing they're grappling with. And because self-compassion is actually kind of hard for a lot of people, they're prepared to be compassionate for their children, their loved ones, their pet, their, you know, aging grandmother, what have you, but it's hard for them to be compassionate to themselves. That inner critic that I was talking about earlier, that mean and nasty and unfair judge inside the head starts yapping away. And we got to say, thank you for sharing. Uh-huh. You have anything new to say? No? Shut up, then. All right? Anyway, I got the memo. Shut up. Turn towards self-compassion. A great way to light up the neural circuits, kind of warm them up and prime them for self-compassion, is to bring to awareness the felt sense of being cared about by somebody. It could be being cared about by a pet, by God, by a spirit being, an angel, a grandmother who's no longer alive, a friend or lover today, what have you. But to bring to mind the sense of being with that person, and bring to mind the feeling. That's the critical point, the feeling of being cared about. And then bring compassion to yourself. Get on your own side and make a plan. By the way, I should say that for me is first aid, those 4 steps. You know, notice what you're feeling, 1. 2, bring compassion to yourself. 3, get on your own side. 4, make a plan. And with practice, you know, that's 5 seconds. You've worked through those steps. You know, without practice, maybe it's a minute or two. But those 4 things are emergency, you know, that's emergency first aid for being upset or bothered or threatened by something.
Notice what
you're feeling. Yeah. Notice what you're feeling. Be compassionate. Get on your own side and make a plan. And then take action.
I love that. In fact, I'm going to post that on my own bulletin board and train my brain to think like that, so that that's just natural. It's second nature. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. We got so much out of it. So I'm going to say goodbye to everybody. Attitude Builders, as you know, is at www.attitudebuilders.com. It is designed for busy leaders, owners, and professionals who want to maximize their results and increase personal effectiveness and productivity. Remember this, when your thinking changes, so do your results. Until next time, this is Marlene Chisholm with Stop Your Drama and Attitude Builders, wishing you a drama-free workplace with more of the three P's, peace, prosperity, and purpose.